Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
And hello, Natasha Mitchell with you on ABC Radio National this Easter weekend. This is All in the Mind, and we're seeking your inner ape today on the program.
Come on, everybody, it's Gibbon time!
The funky Gibbon.
We are here to show you how.
Anybody who has been ever observing chimpanzees, you are very likely to feel that they are very similar. But then again, we have to remain skeptical and scientific. And I would say that definitely they have emotions. But what they are like in the chimpanzee mind, I don't know.
Chimp minds. Today on the show, my Berlin-based colleague, science journalist Volkart Wildermuth, is catching up with the world's leading scientists, attempting to probe the inner life of our closest relatives. Close, yes, and yet so far.
Watching baboons is like reading a 19th century novel of somebody like Jane Austen, where the two rules in life seem to be marry up if you can, and be nice to your relatives if they're not too embarrassing to you.
Some people have argued that cooperation requires knowledge and that other animals may not be smart enough. But I think that view is suffering under the weight of the evidence.
We think there may be a certain focus on habit that maybe sticks chimpanzees at a certain level so they don't easily move up onto the next sort of innovation that we so easily do.
Chimpanzees. They seem so similar to us in their gestures and expressions, and yet so different. These creatures feel like our closest kin, and they are. Apes and humans share 95 to 99% of the same genes. So what is that really distinguishes us? What makes humans such a dominant force on our planet? In recent years, scientists have developed a battery of special IQ tests, psychological tests, and tools for studying the complex social networks of primate groups. One surprise comes from observation of chimpanzees in their natural habitat. These apes appear to have their own form of culture. And this differs between different communities of the same species. Primatologist Professor Andrew Whiten, whose fieldwork takes him from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland to the wild forests of Africa.
If you walk across to Africa, you'll see different peoples acting in different ways, but you'll also see the same with the chimpanzees. So in far West Africa, for example, you'll find chimpanzees who crack open nuts using natural hammer stones and pieces of wood. If you go to East Africa, there are places there where we know there are the nuts and there are the raw materials, but they don't do the nut cracking. And that's just one example of 39 that we've identified in the chimpanzee world. So it's a small set for chimpanzees relative to humans, but compared to any other animal, so far as we know, it's perhaps the most complex, the biggest cultural repertoire.
How do chimpanzees learn their culture? When the little chimp grows up, how does he learn to crack nuts in one region and to hold up his hands in greeting in another region?
For example, in the case of termite fishing, which perhaps many people have seen on the television, where the chimpanzee takes a little stick or a stem and inserts it in down the tunnel in a termite mound, the termites bite onto it, and then the chimpanzee carefully pulls it out. That sounds quite easy. In fact, it is quite skillful. And if you're a human, you may spend, you know, half an hour trying to do it without much success. But the youngsters watch their mothers, and what's been found is that the young females watch their mothers more intently. The little boy chimpanzees are playing in the bushes and fighting, and it all sounds a bit familiar. But what's been discovered is not only do the young females spend more time looking at their mothers, they also acquire the behaviour much earlier. And even the length of the tool that the mother prefers, the youngster tends to have the same. The problem is, in the wild, it's difficult to be absolutely sure of that. And it's for that reason we've also started doing experiments with chimpanzees in captivity to really be sure of just what they're socially learning.
These experiments made quite a stir. You try to start a culture in a chimpanzee group. So how do you start a culture in a zoo?
So one important thing is to have two groups, and in one of those groups we present them with some apparatus where there is some food they can see, some grape, let's say, that they really want, but it's stuck behind some blockage and they can't get at it. And we've designed this apparatus so that there are two very different ways to succeed in getting that food out. So what we do is we go to one of our groups, we take one chimpanzee out, and we select a high-ranking female. So what we do is teach her one way to get that food out. We'd put that chimpanzee back with her group, and the answer is, well, yes, as time went on over several weeks, it spread across all the group except one. So that's obviously showing the social learning going on, because in our control group, they didn't learn it. But that could just be simply that, well, maybe they've worked out that there's food in that thing, and I'm a chimpanzee, I'll work out a way to do it, and so they get busy with their stick and they end up doing all the same thing. But then remember, we've got the other group where we've actually seeded a completely different technique, and we found that that also spread, as it were, differentially just in that group. And that shows us that there's much more going on in social learning. There is some kind of copying process of what that first model did.
So it is finally proven. Chimps can sustain a kind of culture by learning from each other. Given that, the big question is, why didn't they move out of the bush and stop building airplanes? Professor Michael Tomasello at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Germany is keen to know the answer. His approach is to compare the mind of a chimp and the mind of a human to look for crucial differences. He and his team designed a battery of IQ tests suited for all primates, and he's compared the ability of human kids and apes head to head. The kids were 2.5 years old. They were talking, but had no formal education whatsoever. In the physical domain, in thinking about space, causality or quantity, kids and chimps were more or less in the same league. However, in one field, chimps outsmarted humans.
Yes, they were better at keeping track when different quantities of food were hidden on different occasions in the bucket and you had to accumulate them or summate them across time. The chimps were better than the young children were. But of course, chimps are really, food is really important for them and they really track it carefully. In our study, cognition of the physical world was basically the same. In the social cognition, so social learning and communication and so-called theory of mind, that's where the kids were much better. And these are little 2.5-year-olds. They already are communicating in unique ways, for example, by pointing. And so the idea is that the special species unique social skills they have already at 2 years of age enables them to learn from others and to soak up culture, to soak up education, and that then transforms all of their cognition, including of the physical world, and makes it uniquely human.
Could you describe what these primary social skills are? I think one of these experiments was that they had to extract something from a box and someone had showed them how to do it. How were the children different from the chimps?
Yeah. Our test actually tested for copying the method used. So let's say we used an unusual way to open a box. The children tended to copy the unusual way, whereas the chimps would see that the box opens and try to figure out a way to open it themselves. And so in quite a number of cases, the chimps were successful at opening the box, but they did it in their own way. And I think that's what would be true of almost all animal species that could relate to this task. Humans are special in the degree to which they copy and mimic one another. And even in adults, we see fads and fashions and things where people just mimic others just to be like others and to be one of the group. Children have already started doing this. We have previous studies showing that even if the adult does something that's actually not very useful, the children will copy it anyway.
That is an important difference. Humans are so keen to imitate that they even imitate complete nonsense, whereas chimps have a more down-to-earth approach and do the sensible thing. That might be one reason why in nature new tricks spread only rarely throughout the ape kingdom. One important difference between the traditions of chimpanzees and the culture of humans is we tend to band together and cooperate towards a common goal. Cooperation can be found elsewhere in the animal world, but not on the same scale. A beehive would be one example. Chimpanzees joining forces to hunt down a red colobus monkey is another one. Primatologist Professor John Silk is interested in how evolution shaped the social organization of primates. In Africa and at her lab at the University of California in Los Angeles, she investigates the social ties amongst baboons and chimpanzees.
Some people have argued that cooperation requires knowledge and that other animals may not be smart enough. But I think that view is suffering under the weight of the evidence. So in observational data, we now see that animals are keeping track of their grooming relationships over fairly long periods of time, matters of months. We've done experiments in the lab that show that primates, under some circumstances, can master fairly complicated cooperative tasks. And it doesn't seem that's a constraint, so that evolution could have acted on the abilities that primates have to enable them to master these kinds of tasks if it was in their evolutionary interest.
Yeah, but cooperation seemed to pay off. In your baboon work, you show that it pays to have friends which come to help.
The females who spend the most time associating with others and grooming others are more likely to rear their infants successfully than the females who are more socially isolated. And this, of course, is very much like the data from people. So we have really good evidence from people that sociality has very positive effects on health and on mortality.
Being a male, I have to ask, what about male baboons?
Ah, males. Male baboons and also male chimpanzees use coalitions and form alliances which enhance their mating success. So in baboons, two middle-ranking males may team up to try and steal a female away from a much higher-ranking male. Chimpanzees do something similar, but it's because their chimps are a little bit more sophisticated. In at least one group, in at least one period of time, the alpha male, who is very powerful, rewarded his allies for their support by allowing them to mate with receptive females. And so the mating success of non-alpha males was how often they supported the alpha male, not their own dominance rank.
This is rather surprising, because sex is a very important thing in primate society. And another important thing, food, they seem not so willing to share, at least that's what your experiments suggest.
We did some experiments to basically ask whether or not chimps would take advantage of opportunities to provide food to other group members. They didn't always refuse to give food to another chimp, and they didn't always give food to another chimp. They were sort of indifferent. They sort of chose at random.
They are oblivious to the need of the chimp next door. This mental disposition, not to regard the other guy, not even to be very tolerant, might well be a major roadblock for the evolution of a more elaborate chimpanzee culture.
One of the things very useful about primate groups was that the group was this place where other animals could learn things. And in order to learn things from other individuals, you had to be close enough to get a good look. And so it's entirely possible that tolerance is a first step for a species which relies on social learning. If you can't get close to other animals, you don't have a chance to learn what they know. And it could be that one of the first steps in the evolution of becoming a more cultural animal was becoming a more tolerant one.
Tolerance is the first step to culture. What a nice idea.
And isn't it? Berlin-based science journalist Volkart Wildermuth joins me, Natasha Mitchell, on All in the Mind today. We're contemplating the inner life of our closest relatives. You're with ABC Radio National and across the world on Radio Australia and as podcast, Radio for All Primates.
Competition is rife in chimpanzee groups. It pays to be on top, and there are often fights to establish dominance. But there seems to be a softer side to chimp society too. Warring chimps tend to make up afterwards, and bystanders even come to comfort both the winner and the loser with a pat or a hug. When I watch this in the zoo, I can't help but think that these creatures care for one another, that they are empathic. In recent years, this idea of the empathic ape has attracted scientific attention as a possible origin of human morality. But Dr. Sonia Koski from the University of Cambridge, England, took a closer look at this key behavior and was in for a surprise.
In chimpanzees, a reliable stress indicator is self-scratching. And it's quite funny to start observing humans, because we do that too. When we're nervous, we fidget and scratch and touch our hair and touch our face. And chimpanzees do the same thing. The levels of scratching, they are elevated, significantly elevated after conflict. So they clearly are responding to this aggressive behavior. But they did not decrease after receiving this consolatory contact. We know from several primate species, also chimpanzees, that there's a tendency for the conflict participants to continue their aggressive behavior towards other group members. So the working hypothesis here was that since there is a danger for the bystander to receive this kind of further aggression, they might try to prevent it, as if showing a peace sign or white flag that don't beat me, beat another guy, that I'm your friend. And that's exactly what seems to be happening.
There was this huge interest in the idea that chimps are empathic, and it's not only about fighting, it's much about making up after fights. Do you think that this was a little bit overblown, this idea that monkeys and chimps have the tendency to care for the group?
I wouldn't say it's overblown. It's a very relevant feature of group living species that have individualized relationships. And I think we have to sort of keep the both views in balance. It's a very relevant question of how morality evolved or how prosociality evolved. It's very true that humans are extensively prosocial and cooperative and altruistic. And it didn't come from nothing, but we don't know at which point of evolution it actually started to emerge and whether it has emerged in other lineages and for what reasons.
Imitation, empathy, there's another ingredient of human culture that we are still missing, and that is language. Humans talk a lot, they talk to convey ideas, they talk to convey feelings. Many species vocalize to mark their territory, to impress mates, to warn that a predator is around. Human language is certainly more special than this. There are no limits to our expressive power, it seems. But primatologist Professor Dorothy Cheney from the University of Pennsylvania is convinced that monkeys hear a lot more than they talk. She studies baboons in Botswana, where they live in a strict hierarchical society of maternal groups. Each monkey knows its place in its own family and the place of the family in the whole community. Baboons have to calculate complex social relations, and that could be one root of our own grammatical gifted mind.
We often say that watching baboons is like reading a 19th century novel of somebody like Jane Austen, where the two rules in life seem to be marry up if you can, and be nice to your relatives if they're not too embarrassing to you, but otherwise try to curry favors.
Language, many people think, is something that really separates humans from other animals, that there's a huge gap and no intermediates. So where do you see the precursors of language?
Well, people are correct in thinking there is a huge gap, first of all. And I think that gap is particularly strong in the domain of vocal production. Most animals don't produce anything like human language in the sense that their calls are pretty inflexible and not modifiable. Their vocabularies don't grow during their lifetime, for example. But when you look at vocal perception, of course, they're much more like humans. And you can teach a dog, for example, many different words very easily. And in the context of primate behavior, it's quite clear that monkeys have many different concepts for which they don't have words. They can recognize each other's kinship relations, dominance, ranks. And just by hearing these very simple sounds, screams, threat grunts, people originally thought were tied only to emotion, monkeys can extract very meaningful and interesting narratives of the world around them.
What is a connection to language?
So when a baboon hears a sequence of calls, she's taking in lots of different information that nonetheless retain their discrete properties. She's taking into account who is that individual, so she recognizes the individual caller. What type of call is she giving? Is it a threat grunt? Is it a scream? Is it a friendly grunt? And who is she interacting with? Who is the participant? And so in that sense, it's very similar in some ways to the sort of combinatorial system that we find in human language, where words are combined, but each word in itself retains its meaning. Yeah, I'm not trying to say that these animals have a language or they have grammar. What I'm saying instead is that the primate mind, and perhaps many other animals' mind, is predisposed to take elements in their world, other individuals' actions, sounds, and combine them in a way that isn't quite like a sentence, for sure, but something beginning to approach it.
So the big question is, when primates are expert listeners, when they have these concepts in their mind, why don't they start and talk as well?
I think, and many other people also think, that this has to do with the lack of what we call a theory of mind in animals other than humans. So, for example, if I'm a baboon and I see a predator, I'll give an alarm call, but I won't change my alarm calling behavior depending on whether or not I think you're ignorant. I'll simply call with respect to my own knowledge. And perhaps for that reason, animals like monkeys and perhaps also chimpanzees have many, many concepts that they never articulate, and it may be that they're not motivated to articulate them because they don't recognize that their audience doesn't know what they know.
Taking the other into account, this seems to be a uniquely human ability. Chimpanzees can help other chimps or humans, but as Professor Michael Tomasello emphasizes, they never work together towards a common goal.
Yes, I think that is really the main difference, is that humans' communication evolved in the context of cooperative activities. And so I think one of the reasons chimps haven't evolved this cooperative mode of communication where you just tell one another things and show one another things helpfully is because it didn't evolve in the context of these cooperative activities.
You think that the pointing gesture is a very important step from the ape stage of things to the human stage of things?
The reason I think pointing is so important is because it presupposes some of the what I call the infrastructure of human communication. So if I just point now in this direction for you, it doesn't mean anything. The pointing by itself, there's no information in my finger sticking out. But if we know together, for example, that you're looking for your videotape or something, and I point in that direction and you look and you see it, then my point is automatically meaningful. So this shared understanding is what gives pointing its meaning. By itself, it doesn't mean anything. And chimpanzees and other great apes don't point for one another. They do something with humans, but when they do it, it's only when they want something from the humans. And we humans point for one another to help others with their own goals.
Pointing is the first step towards language, argues Michael Tomasello. But chimpanzees remain stuck in the sphere of their own mind. They hunt together and coordinate their activities, but they don't share a common goal the way humans do. Think of a baby tumbling a brick tower over and over again, her mother rebuilding it each time. Both share a common goal, and the fun is not only in the project itself, but in doing it together. This mutual effort was a truly human innovation in the evolutionary road to Homo sapiens. Once cooperation was conquered by our ancestors, culture took off. Anthropologist Professor Robert Boyd from the University of California in Los Angeles.
What makes it different is humans, to a much greater extent than chimps, can essentially pile one improvement upon another. And so we rely on the fact that our population learns for us over generations. And until we have beautiful, elaborate, culturally transmitted bits of technology, which are what make possible human ecological success. And the difference is that chimps and capuchins and dolphins, other creatures that seem to have cultural transmission, seems to be more important than the sort of common run of mammals, they don't seem to be able to do this to the same degree.
We've just completed an experiment in which we tried to look at this cumulative problem because we're well aware that that surely is a big gap between our culture and chimpanzees.
Primatologist Andrew Whiten.
Although they have all these different traditions, they never really seem to get much beyond how one would imagine it was invented in the first place, even though it gets passed on. So what we've done is an experiment where all they had to do was open a little lid up and then stick a stick in and get some honey from a mixture of honey and nuts that was inside there. It was quite tricky to do, but they learned that by observation, so they could do that. But then we had a more complicated technique they could use, which involved sticking the stick in somewhere else, releasing a mechanism which allowed the whole lid to open up, and then they could get all the honey and all the nuts. And we showed them how to do that, but they didn't learn it. It was as if they had a technique that worked, the simple one, and they didn't move up that cumulative scale to incorporate that into this more complex technique. We think there may be a certain focus on habit that maybe sticks chimpanzees at a certain level so they don't easily move up onto the next sort of innovation that we so easily do.
Chimps are even greater traditionalists than humans. Andrew Whiten's experiment nicely backs up the theoretical reasoning of Robert Boyd. Since chimps stick to what they know, they couldn't get onto the fast lane of innovation. When our ancestors discovered cumulative culture, they were propelled into a new sphere of evolution, argues Robert Boyd, which set us finally apart from the other apes and gave us our big, big brain. An evolution in which the focus of Darwinian selection is less on the bodies and minds of individuals, but more on the cultural innovations of groups. Until recently, group selection was almost a forbidden word in biology. But in Robert Boyd's view, the different levels of selection are not antagonistic, they work hand in hand.
So we can live with our mother's relatives or we can live with our father's relatives. We can agree that we have to go to war with our brothers or we have to go to war with our maternal relatives, for example. We can agree that you have to transmit property to the oldest son, or we can agree that we should transmit property equally to all heirs. And then people who deviate from those rules within societies are subject to moral sanctions. It's in individuals' interest within each group to do what people in the local environment do. And so there's no conflict between selection at the group level and the individual level, or individual advantage within the groups. Once you have that, then you have an engine for between-group selection, selecting amongst different social arrangements, all of them consistent with individual self-interest, but all maybe having quite different effects on the average welfare of individuals in the group, the ability of groups to compete with each other economically or militarily or whatever.
Can this group-level selection, this cultural selection, have any effects back on the biological basis of our behavior?
Absolutely. So we know for sure that cultural changes can have an effect on genetic evolution. We know that for things like lactose tolerance. A hypothesis that I'm interested in is that this cultural group selection has been going on long enough that it's created social environments in which pro-social behaviors are rewarded and antisocial behaviors are punished. And then that creates not group selection, but ordinary natural selection for people who stay out of trouble, basically.
Our way of dealing with the world seems to be hugely successful. We covered more or less all of the globe. The chimps are on the brink of extinction. So is there any roadblock for them? Are they in a kind of psychological dead end which hinders them to go in this way?
In the Miocene, there were many species of apes, many more than there are now. And really, the chimps and the gorillas and the orangutans are the last of their breed, so to speak. 15 million years ago or 20 million years ago, the world was all forest, basically. The shrinking of the forests has shrunken the range that chimps and gorillas can live in, and that seems to be where selection is taking them. So I think it takes an extraordinary set of events to generate not just human minds, but lots of complex adaptations. Chimps are missing some of those things, so I don't think they're going to. It's not like we're all climbing the same ladder towards culture or whatever.
These creatures that we feel so connected to are vanishing all over Africa. And with them vanishes a unique window into an alternative primate mind. Humans are a very special animal, but let's not forget, chimpanzees are special animals as well. It would be a pity if our children could only see and relate to them at the zoo. Volker Wildermuth in Berlin for All in the Mind.
And thanks to science journalist Volkart Wildermuth, channeling his inner ape. I'll pop a link to the conference he went along to for us on our website. All the top primatologists under the one roof recently in Germany. And you'll find the podcast and transcript of today's show on All in the Mind's website, abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. Email us from there too. And discover the All in the Mind blog, meanderings from my own mind to share, and yours too, contribute. And thanks to Anita Barrow, Angie Grant and Russell Thompson today. I'm Natasha Mitchell.
Funky Gibbon.
Until next week, go ape. Have a great long weekend.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.